Today, populism is on the rise. But what does it really mean and how do you measure it? And plain speaking therapy, Sam Delaney on men and mental health.
Maybe somebody can pull up in a dictionary quickly the phrase populism, but I'm not prepared to concede the notion that some of the rhetoric that's been popping up is populist.
Donald Trump's populist can world populist leaders.
National populist movements become
populist authoritarian.
Part of a new wave of populism sweeping through
new populist.
What is the economic impact of these populist uprisings?
What does it mean to be populist?
Populism is on the rise.
Populism. It's the political buzzword of the decade. We use it to explain the vote for Brexit, the rise of Donald Trump, the shift towards hardline policies on immigration, crime and national identity. But what is populism and can we measure it? From The Guardian, I'm Anushka Astana. Today in Focus, the rise of populism and what it means.
So I think the best way of describing populism is a way of doing politics that frames it as a battle between the people and a corrupt, nefarious elite. And I think inherent in that is this idea that there is a single popular will.
Associate editor Paul Lewis has been running a major series into populism for The Guardian.
One of the reasons it was important to cover populism, I think, is because everyone was talking about it at the moment. You had Brexit and you had Trump, and both of those things were, to some degree, I think, populist. And even though when we looked at the way in which it was being covered, I think the P word was being systematically misused, I think we had an obligation to try to tell the story of populism, what it is, the extent to which it's happening and why that might be the case, and to do so in a way that was more faithful to the actual meaning of the word. One thing that you always see is populism is sort of used as a synonym for the far right or nativism or nationalism. I mean, these are all complicated concepts and sometimes they overlap. But one crucial thing about populism is that it can exist on the left or on the right and sometimes even in the centre.
Now, this particular project is about tracking the rise of populist rhetoric in speeches. What were you hoping to accomplish with that?
One of the difficulties we found when we started this project was, unlike if you're sort of studying something like socialism or capitalism, where there's all sorts of different trackers and databases, there was very little research out there showing whether or not populism was on the increase, as many people thought it was, or whether it was declining or staying the same. So I went to a conference in Madrid and met some populism scholars, some academics who study this, and we just got talking about different ways of measuring populism. And it turned out they had a technique for this, which was you look at the speeches of political leaders and you grade or score these speeches according to how much populist rhetoric they have in them.
How do you grade a speech by populist rhetoric?
It's actually not that different to grading an essay if you're a teacher, in that you look at it holistically. You look at the whole speech. It's not just about the number of words or phrases that appear in it, but you have an anchor text. So you have an example of a really popular speech, another example of a moderately popular speech, and an example of a speech that's not populist at all. And you basically look at the extent to which a speech by any given leader has those similar traits.
And there's a scale from 0 to 2 on how populist your speech is.
Yeah.
So who's at 0?
A good example of a non-populist politician would be Tony Blair, whose speeches tend to score somewhere around 0.
Forget the past. No more bosses versus workers. We are on the same side, the same team, and Britain United will win.
But many people would say that Tony Blair represented the elites. I mean, what makes him not populist?
Well, I think if he did represent the elites, certainly he was open to doing business with the political and financial establishment in Britain, that would make him non-populist. I mean, populists do the opposite. They say, I'm here, I represent you, the people, in your battle against the political elites and the establishment of this country. And that's absolutely not what Blair was doing in that speech. And I think rarely did Blair do that during his term as Prime Minister.
So it feels as if the premise for a lot of this is the idea that populism is a bad thing. You know, we think of people like Viktor Orban or Donald Trump, leaders who, you know, we at The Guardian, but maybe even we in Britain would be quite worried about. And that those who are not populists are positive. I mean, why is it automatically a bad thing to think about the will of the people?
I don't think it needs to be. And I think one of the reasons that we've got into a sticky situation with this word is because it has sort of universally negative connotations. I mean, it is true that most of the research shows that most of the time when populists get into power, there are some negative ramifications. So they tend to quite like executive power. That often means overriding the rights of minorities. But that's not universally the case. A lot of it depends on who the populist is and what kind of populist they are.
And what about an example of someone who scored at the higher end of the scale?
The example of the much more populist speech was Sarah Palin.
America is ready for another revolution, and you are a part of this. I look forward to attending more Tea Party events in the near future. It is just so inspiring to see real people, not politicos, not inside the Beltway professionals, come out and stand up and speak out for common sense conservative principles.
So that was Sarah Palin talking about the Tea Party movement. And she was, you know, in many ways the figurehead of that movement. If you listen to what Sarah Palin said just then, I think there's one phrase that jumps out at me, because populists love the term the real people. And it's this notion that if you're not part of our team, if you're not one of the real people, you're part of the sort of nefarious, corrupt, elite or establishment, then you're some sort of quasi-citizen.
The researchers graded, as you said, dozens of political speeches.
Hundreds. 700 and something.
So what were the kind of headline findings?
Well, one of the first things we really wanted to know the answer to was, is populism on the rise? Because everyone's sort of been saying it is, but without much evidence. And I think what this study of 40 countries shows is that, yes, it is. I mean, the number of countries with a leader that is at least somewhat populist has more or less doubled since the early 2000s. And the average populism score that you give to all speeches in all 40 countries has also more or less doubled. So we're seeing many more politicians using populist rhetoric and language, and many more politicians who would classify as at least moderately populist getting into government.
So there's clearly been this huge increase in populism over the past 20 years. And I'm really interested in what causes that. I mean, the kind of things that we think of and that we talk about are the financial crisis, rising inequality. What do you think are the causes of this rise in populism?
Yeah, well, I think it depends on what kind of populism you're talking about. One of the things that researchers up until now have observed is that populism tends to flourish when you have a sense of grievance that people blame on a political establishment that has failed. So you have a crisis of some kind, and then there's a sense that, hold on a second, we elected you to sort this out and you failed to do it.
And so if we go back 2 decades, what was the picture then? How many populist leaders were there?
Back around sort of 2003, 2004, there were only really 2 big countries with populists at the helm, and that was Italy, Silvio Berlusconi, and Venezuela with Hugo Chavez. There were a handful of smaller countries that also had populist leaders. But what's really changed is that in the intervening years, you've had leaders of sometimes quite big countries who weren't previously populist adopting populist discourse. An example would be Recep Erdogan in Turkey or Vladimir Putin in Russia. And also, more recently, you've had some really, really big countries with large populations that for the first time have been electing populists as leaders. And I would put into that category India, the United States, Mexico, Brazil.
Let's talk about some of the leaders who themselves have changed over the years, because that's really interesting. So you mentioned Turkey's Erdogan. Tell me what we've seen him start to do.
Well, funnily enough, when Recep Erdogan first came to power, the populism score given to his speeches, this is early 2000s, was basically the same as Tony Blair.
Demokrasinin bütün vatandaşlarımız tarafından hissedilerek derinleşeceğini herkesin...
You know, he was portraying himself as almost a sort of liberal moderate who had ambitions of joining the European Union. He was very friendly to the Kurdish minority. You know, he was, you know, yes, a sort of political Islamist, but he was definitely not a populist. And one of the things this research has shown is that in the 16 years in which Erdogan has been in power, he's gone from being not populist whatsoever to one of the most populist leaders in our database.
So what sort of speeches is he giving now?
Well, now he rails against the elites all the time.
Türkiye'yi bölgedeki gelişmelerin dışında bırakmak ama çıkacak faturayı da üzerine yıkmak için...
As Turkey started to realize that the ambitions of joining the European Union weren't going to happen, I think Erdogan started to shift his emphasis, and increasingly, you know, he was painting as the nefarious elite international organizations, foreign countries. So increasingly the elite in Turkey, as Erdogan has painted it, has gone from not just being a military establishment within the country, but also people outside as well.
And a similar thing has happened in Hungary with Viktor Orban.
Yeah, Viktor Orban is often portrayed as the sort of prototypical populist.
A helyzet úgy áll, kedves barátaim, hogy el akarják venni az országunkat.
But that wasn't always the case. And when he first came to power as Hungary's prime minister, back in the late 90s and early 2000s, again, similarly to Erdogan, he wasn't populist at all. And we've seen that as time has gone on, he's another leader who's become more populist.
And as well as all these leaders who are becoming more populist, we also have new populist leaders of really big countries like Mexico, Brazil, India, and the US, of course. Can we talk about Donald Trump? Because he's the person I think of as the kind of biggest populist drum banger. But the research shows that he's actually quite different when he's scripted and when he's not scripted. Tell us about that.
Yeah, so it suggests certainly that Trump's populism is not his own. This is a really clever thing that the researchers did. They looked at Trump's speeches when they are scripted, when he's reading off a teleprompter, and then they looked at his remarks when he's off the script. And we know Trump famously is incredibly rambling and goes on these sort of strange, convoluted journeys when he's off script. But what they wanted to find out was the context in which he's most populist. And the answer is when he's reading off the script, when he's reading pre-prepared remarks that have been written for him by somebody else.
Today's ceremony, however, has very special meaning, because today we are not merely transferring power from one administration to another, or from one party to another, but we are transferring power from Washington, D.C., and giving it back to you, the people.
That's both scripted and very populist, and I would say a really good example of something that Trump wouldn't instinctively say unless he was reading it off pre-prepared remarks. And the reason I think that is because Trump is principally a narcissist, and he doesn't think the election in 2016 was transferring power from Washington to the people. He thinks of it as transferring power to himself. And it's not the people who have the power, it's him. There's actually a really funny example of this. Last time I was here talking to you, Anushka, we were talking about Steve Bannon, who I'd spent some time with.
Surely populist.
Very much populist. And you know, much of Trump's populism was given to him by Bannon. But Bannon told me that one of the things that Trump always struggled with was actually the anti-elitism, because he kept saying to Bannon, wait a minute, aren't we the elite? My voters are the elite. We are the best people. We are number one. We can't complain about the elite. We are the elite. He really just struggled with that as a concept.
If he's then being handed his populism, Steve Bannon originally did that. Do we know who's doing it now?
Well, now I would say probably Stephen Miller and Vince Haley, who are two senior White House aides.
Okay, so over 20 years, we've got more populists and leaders who were once not very populist becoming quite populist. Our researchers have studied hundreds of speeches, and what I really want to know is, how populist is Theresa May?
Yeah. Well, instinctively, we would probably all say not populist at all. She seems very calculated, awkward, robotic, cautious. And we were really surprised by this result. So for every single leader in the database, the researchers looked at four speeches. Now, two of Theresa May's speeches were probably, as you would expect, not populist at all. One of them from the campaign was a bit more populist, and the fourth one was just sort of off the scale populist.
What was that?
That was her famous 2016 Citizens of Nowhere speech before the Tory party conference.
But today, too many people in positions of power behave as though they have more in common with international elites than with the people down the road, the people they employ, the people they pass on the street. But if you believe you're a citizen of the world, you're a citizen of nowhere. You don't understand what the very word citizenship means.
This was the first speech Theresa May gave after Brexit, and basically what she was doing was sort of painting Brexit in that somewhat simplistic way in which people sometimes do, which was to say, you know, this was an act of revolt. These were ordinary working class people who just had enough with the political establishment, and this was two fingers up to everyone. And it was her job now as Prime Minister to deliver for them.
And we've actually had her speechwriter at the time, Chris Wilkins, on Today in Focus, and he regretted at least that one line about citizens of nowhere. I mean, was that a particularly populist line?
I think you could definitely make the argument that it was, because it was almost like delegitimizing people who you disagree with. You know, populists sort of often do that. You're either with them or you're not. And if you're not one of the sort of real people, so to speak, then you're sort of invalid.
Maybe that's why it upset people so much. So let me ask you what the consequences of populism are.
I think it depends on which populists and where, but we've been able to use this data to look at overall, statistically, what happens when populists come to power. There's one really surprising finding, actually, which was that, you know, generally speaking, it does result in a decline, quite a significant decline, in economic inequality.
Wow, that sounds like populism is pretty good then.
Yeah, I mean, it's really interesting. And actually, it's one of those tricky situations where the people who did this research for us found there was this correlation or this association, but they can't say with much confidence why it exists. But they have a positive impact on turnout. Far more people take part in elections on the whole when populists are on the ballot. And there are a whole slew of what you would say are pretty negative consequences. And you would sort of put them in the bracket of civil and political rights. So a decline in the quality of the elections. Once they're in power, one thing that overall you see is they like executive power and they extend the reach of the, say, for example, the presidential office. And another really, really big finding is there's a very strong correlation between populists getting into power and press freedoms going down.
So finally, what does all of this mean for the current era of politics we live in? Do you imagine that we will start to see a swing in the other direction? Or are we going to see more and more populism?
Oh, that's a really difficult question. I mean, you know, if you look at the long span of history, populism comes in waves. And certainly we are in the midst of a wave right now. I think in order to answer that question, it depends on what you think the cause of the current spike is. Now, I'm someone who happens to believe a lot of this is wrapped up in technology. And the changes in technology are permanent. And I wonder whether the types of discourse that are being incentivized and encouraged by the platforms which are now completely dominant, Facebook and Twitter and YouTube and the like, the sensationalism, the simplification, the reductionism, the division, is just becoming part and parcel of the way we do politics now. And I think if that's the case, what feels like a temporary spike could turn into something that lasts a lot longer.
And you can read all of Paul Lewis's reporting as part of the New Populism series, complete with video interactives, quizzes, and all the data at theguardian.com. Coming up, the problem with men and mental health. Welcome back. Now, men on average wait longer than women before seeking treatment for mental health problems. It was something that rang true for writer and broadcaster Sam Delaney, who was reluctant to get help when he began to suffer from stress and anxiety. Now new groups run by volunteers and ordinary blokes are springing up around the country to work alongside the professionals and encourage men to open up.
When I was 36, I went to visit my brother at his office and I said, have you got a second for a chat? Because I'd spent weeks just in a frantic state, a state that you would see someone in a movie who was on the run from the law or from gangsters, exhausted, wild-eyed, a thin layer of sweat. It's just in a state of constant panic. I'd be catastrophizing, thinking, what if work dries up and I can't pay the mortgage? You know, normal things that everyone thinks all the time. And yet I had spiraled into a pit of almost despair about these things. And my brother, who is 8 years older than me, this is a bloke with a shaved head. He's covered in West Ham tattoos. He's tugging on a cigarette. He's constantly scowling and swearing. If you didn't know him, you'd find him an intimidating presence in the street. But I know him better than that. And I said to him, I can't stop worrying. I'm a mess. And he just shrugged and said, yeah, I've noticed that. You're completely nuts and you better go and see a doctor. Growing up, I lived in a small house with three much older brothers and my mum, who was a single parent. And so it was quite chaotic. It was extremely blokish. There was a lot of drink and drugs from a very young age that I was exposed to and that was quite normalised. It seemed sort of, I suppose, at times exciting and at times a bit scary. And being a man surrounded those kind of cultural touchstones, you know, football, beer, drugs, music. I learned from an early age therapy was having a drink or having a spliff or whatever else was about and losing yourself in that. My concern about opening up about mental health issues was that I would be sucked into a world that I would feel profoundly uncomfortable in. A world of therapy speak and mindfulness speak. My brother said, don't worry about that. It's happened to me loads of times. And I said, well, what'd they do? He goes, they might give you some pills, send you to talk to someone. And he was very open about this being a thing that to him was just natural. I went to this thing called Andy's Man Club. It's a network of clubs across the country that are run every Monday night at 7 o'clock. And it's just a forum that is completely unmoderated by any mental health professional where blokes get together and literally just chat and share their problems. I was with a mate. We enjoyed it. We turned up and these blokes were a laugh. There was no kind of earnestness about it. And a lot of it was people just talking about the real practicalities of their life that was bothering them. There was laughter. There was a little bit of piss taking, but the right amount and at the right times. And this isn't for all blokes. But it's well known that suicide is the biggest killer of men in this country under the age of 45. And it's on the increase. And that's terrifying. I think a lot of what you hear is, well, men need to be better about opening up and sharing their emotions. But I think that's the wrong way of thinking of it. I think we, society, whatever you want to call it, need to be better at identifying men who are struggling and finding different ways of helping them. I would hope that future generations, like my son's generation, will be naturally more open about his feelings. But in the here and now, there is a generation of guys who can't do that, and we can't just expect them to change.
That was Sam Delaney. You can read his feature on men and mental health, which is part of a Guardian special on masculinity, at theguardian.com. My thanks to Sam and Paul Lewis. Today's episode was produced by Mithili Rao and Amar Kalliah. Sound design was by Axel Cucoutier. The executive producers are Nicole Jackson and Phil Maynard. See you tomorrow.